From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a disturbing view of operations inside the White House from former journalist Doyle McManus. In his new book, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984-88, McManus portrays the Reagan administration as one run by unelected aides and pollsters. Also today, Nick Toshis describes the world of loan sharks and numbers runners. It's the subject of his new novel. Toshis is best known for his book Hellfire, an autobiography of rocker Jerry Lee Lewis. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from drummer Jack DeJohnette and his band Special Edition. And David Bianculli shares his thoughts on NBC's coverage of the Olympics and on a couple of new network sitcoms. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. According to a new book, one White House aide was on the verge of recommending removing President Reagan from office in March of 1987, based on reports that the Reagan White House was in chaos and the president was out of control. My guest, Doyle McManus, is the co-author of Landslide, an investigative study of President Reagan's second term. The authors conclude that although President Reagan could be magnetic in public, behind the scenes in the White House, he was uninformed, careless, passive, and indecisive, demonstrating a peculiar lack of curiosity about his own policies. They describe his leadership style as crossing the line from delegation to abdication. Doyle McManus is a Washington reporter for the LA Times. His co-author, Jane Mayer, has covered politics and the White House for the Wall Street Journal. The 25th Amendment of the Constitution says that the president may be removed from office if he is determined to be unfit to serve by the vice president and a majority of either Congress or the principal officers of the executive departments. This provision has never been invoked, but according to my guest, Doyle McManus, the possibility of using it against President Reagan was brought up last year. Before Howard Baker took over as President Reagan's third chief of staff in 1987, Baker sent his aide, Jim Cannon, to check out some rumors he was hearing about Reagan's White House.
Howard Baker asked Cannon, who was an old hand in Washington, he had been Gerald Ford's domestic policy advisor in the Ford White House, Baker asked Cannon to go into the White House, spend a couple of days there, talk to the senior staff, and find out what was wrong. It was clear to everyone that something had gone wrong in that White House. This was in the aftermath of the Tower Commission report, which had reported that there was chaos in the White House staff structure. It was at a point when the Reagan administration was still awash in the Iran-Contra scandal and couldn't seem to find a way to climb out of it. So Cannon spent two full days in the White House interviewing virtually the entire senior staff. And they told him that, from their standpoint, the problem was that the president himself wasn't focusing on the job. They called him, and these are the staff speaking, they used words like lazy, inept. They said he was inattentive. He wouldn't focus on the job. He wouldn't look at the documents that they sent to him for his approval. He seemed to want to spend time in the residence section of the White House watching television rather than come in to work in the morning. And in one of those meetings, Cannon discovered that some aides in the White House had even been signing Ronald Reagan's initials to decision documents, in effect making official decisions on the part of the president. And no one was even sure whether the president had seen the documents in the first place. And when Cannon asked them, well, who has the authority to do that? Who has the authority to use Ronald Reagan's initials? They couldn't give him an answer. There wasn't a rule. They said everyone and no one.
When Cannon started following the president around himself to try to get a first-hand grasp of what was happening, what did he find?
Well, that was the next morning. That was Monday morning after Cannon had written or discussed using the 25th Amendment with Baker. And it wasn't just Cannon. At that point, Howard Baker and two of his other aides decided that they had better observe Ronald Reagan firsthand to see if he was still up to the job. And so they spent the better part of the day following him around, attending meetings with him. They went into a meeting in the cabinet room and made sure that one of them was sitting on either side of the president, two were across the table so that they could look into his eyes, as one of them told us. And they found that he seemed to be the same Ronald Reagan we've always known. He was charming, he was affable, he told stories, he told jokes. And Cannon looked at this and thought, what on earth is going on here? The old fellow looks just dandy. And so he was left with these two two irreconcilable pictures, one of a president who was so inattentive that he wasn't making the decisions that were sent to him, and another of a man who could somehow make it through a meeting and carry off the same kind of performance he has for years.
How did you find out about this story?
Well, it took a long time. We had heard just the barest hint of a rumor, and my co-author, Jane Mayer of the Wall Street Journal, and I contacted Cannon. He didn't want to talk about it at first. It took, I think, four interviews to get to the point where Cannon was talking about the 25th Amendment, and a fifth interview to pin down the details. It was just a matter of long, plain old reporting.
Now, Cannon decided to drop the idea of using the 25th Amendment to get the president out of office. What was his final decision based on?
Well, it was based on the fact that the idea of using the 25th Amendment was a kind of worst-case scenario. He was not recommending to Baker that they do it. He was recommending to Baker that they take a serious look at it. Mm-hmm. Clearly, those guys knew that this was a constitutional crisis they were talking about. Howard Baker had been on the Senate Watergate Committee. He knew what a constitutional crisis was like. Clearly, it was something they wanted to avoid. And when they went into that series of meetings on Monday morning and found that Ronald Reagan seemed to be in command of his faculties, seemed to be able to make it through a meeting without embarrassing everyone in the room, I think they looked at each other and said, here's one constitutional crisis we can live without.
My guest is Doyle McManus, and he's the Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times and the co-author of a new investigative book called Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988. Now, you've looked into how the president has spent a typical day in office, what his typical working day was like, and you've discovered it was a pretty short working day on the average.
It's a pretty light schedule from the standpoint of chief executives or major government officials. The president gets into the office between 9 and 9:30. He's generally out the door by 4:30. He takes Wednesday afternoon off and Friday afternoon off. He keeps his weekends light, and he spends an hour every afternoon in the gym. Incidentally, the schedule and also the time in the gymnasium is one reason that he looks better now than he did when he came into office.
But that's considered very important, I suppose, that he does look good.
Well, this has been a White House that has been unusually attentive to the maintaining the president's image and unusually good at it. And Ronald Reagan, the fact that he is an actor by training can be overdone, but there's no question that he has always been conscious of the necessity to be rested, to be in good physical shape, to take on the kind of performances he has to.
Now, you write that throughout his years in office, President Reagan has relied on a cue card system to tell him not only what to say in public meetings, but even during telephone calls, and that he was always briefed with cue cards that would tell him what to say and what to, quote, improvise. Would you describe how the cue card system works?
Sure. It was. We've always known that the president used cue cards to some extent during meetings, but we were surprised when we did our reporting to find out how elaborate the system was. He has two different sizes. They come in four different colors, red ones for secret information, yellow for another kind, green and white for different kinds of information, different kinds of meetings. And we were surprised to find that his lines are scripted sometimes even down to the banter he will use in a meeting, even down to the good morning, it's nice to see you all. He also gets a kind of a guideline script that tells him where he's going to stand, where he's going to sit. And on one of those, it was discovered that he had a helpful hint on how to recognize one of his own cabinet members. The script said that the cabinet member would be the man sitting under the portrait of Calvin Coolidge.
Is this at all typical for a president, this elaborate credit cue card system?
Well, all politicians who do a lot of public events rely on some kind of system, but I don't think we have seen any other president who has leaned quite as heavily on cue cards as this one. It should be said he doesn't always follow the cue cards exactly, and in fact sometimes to the despair of his own aides. One of them told us that President Reagan has always had a difficult time delivering a tough message to anyone. He has never, as far as we know, actually fired anyone who worked for him. And whenever they wanted to deliver a tough message, for example, to a foreign leader, they said, we've got to watch him very closely, otherwise he'll just wimp out. He won't do it.
You describe a basic contradiction in the Reagan presidency, that in public he's always given the appearance of the activist president, but in the White House he's been a very passive president. And one example that you give of that is right after his reelection, when his national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, presented him with a binder of possible foreign policy initiatives to undertake during his second term. And tell what happened.
Well, what happened was, as President Reagan won his 49-state landslide in 1984, McFarlane, who was then national security advisor, and George Shultz, who was and is still Secretary of State, decided it was time to come up with an agenda for the second term foreign policy. And so they got together. They put together a Chinese menu, if you like, of policy choices. And these were big picture items: an arms control breakthrough, peace in the Middle East, a common market in Asia, really major priorities. And McFarlane sent this binder into the president at his ranch above Santa Barbara with a message that said, Mr. President, we can get some of these things done, but we've got to choose at most two or three to concentrate on. Otherwise, our energies will be dissipated and we won't get them done. And so in went the memo to the president, and McFarlane waited. And a week later, the memo came back with the president's scrawl in the margin reading, let's do them all. And McFarlane remembers admiring how optimistic that sentiment was, but at the same time really being in despair because he was getting no direction at all from the president. And it was at that point, McFarlane told us later, that he decided that if he was going to get anything done in the second term on foreign policy, in his words, I'd just have to do it myself. And in that decision, you can see some of the roots of the Iran-Contra affair, because there was a whole series of aides who failed to get clear direction from the president and decided to take matters into their own hands.
So you think that Reagan left something of a power vacuum in the White House, making it possible for other people to make decisions that traditionally they shouldn't be making in their role?
It's clear that he left a power vacuum. He set the essential themes and the essential goals. Let there be no question about the fact that Ronald Reagan wanted to get the hostages out of Beirut. He was in favor of sending arms to Khomeini. He was in favor of supporting the Contras. He was in favor of keeping taxes down and all the other priorities that we know. But he really gave his people virtually no guidance on how to achieve those goals, and so that was left up to them.
Give us a sense of the kind of power jockeying going on behind the scenes among White House aides.
Well, let me take one example. There was always a tremendous fight over what would go into the president's speeches. Number one, because he was such an effective speech maker. Number two, because what went into the speeches really determined what national policy would be. And so every year when the president's State of the Nation address came up, there was a tremendous battle among the different parts of the bureaucracy to see who would get what favorite programs into the speech. In effect, they were setting out the goals for the year. And in 1986, two things happened. First, there was a process by which different drafts were bootlegged around, and finally, Donald Regan, the chief of staff, took control of the process entirely and took it, in fact, out of the hands of the White House speechwriting staff itself. The outcome of that was that President Reagan himself didn't know what was going into his speech, didn't know what draft was the real draft. At one point, three different drafts from three different White House offices came to him, and he turned to one of his aides and said, I wish the fellas would tell me what they want to do. I can't give three different speeches. And in that process, Reagan himself lost any real control over what went into his speech.
My guest is Doyle McManus, and we're discussing some of the things he's uncovered in his new book, Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988. The book is co-authored with Jane Mayer. McManus is the Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. We'll talk more about the Reagan presidency after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Journalist Doyle McManus is my guest, co-author of Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988. Before our break, you were just comparing a couple of things up between Reagan's first and second terms. Another comparison you make between the first and second terms is you say that that the public relations machinery worked better for Reagan in the first term than in the second. And in the second term, his aides devised policies to keep Reagan popular rather than the other way around, to keep Reagan popular in order to get policies through. And an example that you give is how his pollster, Richard Werthelin, was just test marketed every single phrase that Reagan said before the public.
The extent of polling in this White House has really been remarkable. Every president has used polls since the invention of the device. But as far as we could determine, no White House has used polls quite to the extent this one did. Werthelin, who is still the administration's main pollster, had a system that he had in fact adopted from Hollywood, which uses it for the test marketing of movies and television pilots. And it's called, in Werthelin's case, he called it Speech Pulse. And what he did was he would take a group of people into a room, wire them up, and show videotapes of Ronald Reagan speeches. And the audience would react not just to each theme or each policy idea, but to each phrase in that speech with a dial that would show either a positive response or a negative response. And by doing that, Werthelin and the speechwriters could then chart precisely what words and what phrases evoked a positive response and try and get more of those into each speech. Werthelin called these resonators.
As the pollster, did he also recommend policy?
Well, he clearly did recommend policy. This isn't unusual for a pollster. What I think is unusual in this White House is the extent to which, in the second term, the polls became the major index of success. Donald Regan, as chief of staff, was a man of Wall Street, and he really saw the polls as his equivalent of market research. And any time a reporter went in to ask Regan whether a given policy was a good idea, Regan had these big black binders of Werthelin's polls on the shelf behind his desk, and he'd pull them down, and he could flip immediately to a number and show how a given policy was successful. The other innovation in this White House was a remarkable degree of polling even on secret foreign policy initiatives. We discovered that the White House commissioned a secret poll before the bombing of Libya to determine whether the public would accept that operation or not. This at a time when the White House was also accusing the press and some senators of leaks on that sort of thing. It turns out they were out there asking ordinary citizens how they would feel about a bombing raid on Tripoli. And it was not until after those poll results came in that the White House, that the president, went ahead and okayed that raid.
You also suggest that the anti-drug campaign undertaken by the president and the first lady was at the suggestion of Reagan's pollster.
Well, they were looking for an issue that was a consensus issue among the country, and that was also drug interdiction was an issue that was a major negative for the administration. There were a lot of questions among the public as to why the administration had failed to do anything about it. Now, I should say that, again, that polling is not unheard of, but what did happen in the second term is that the president's core agenda, the initial policies that he came into office with in 1981, had run out of gas. He had achieved his initial goals. The people who had pushed those forward had basically moved out of the White House. And so instead of, in effect, moving the Reagan agenda forward, they resorted to polling to find out what the agenda ought to be.
Let's talk about Iran-Contra. One of the main questions that the public has asked is, what did Reagan know? Was there a smoking gun? Given the picture that you've drawn of the White House, where the president was actually really not initiating most of the policies, but was rather pretty passively accepting the judgment of his aides, is that the essential question? How much did Reagan know?
I don't think it is the essential question about Iran-Contra. I think the essential question is, how did a White House arise? How did the circumstances arise in which this kind of operation could occur? It's clearly an important question, though, and I have to tell you that Jane and I started out in this in reporting this book as a couple of cynical, we thought tough Washington reporters, and we were sure that Ronald Reagan had to know about the diversion of funds from Iran to the Contras. We could not conceive of an operation like that being carried out without the knowledge of the President of the United States. But after spending a year and a half researching the way he made decisions, or more properly, did not make decisions, we now don't know the answer. The unthinkable turned out to be quite thinkable indeed.
So, what about the question of George Bush? How much, through your investigation, do you think George Bush knew about the trading of arms for hostages and then the diversion of the arms money to the Contras?
Well, it's clear, and Vice President Bush has acknowledged, that he did attend meetings about the Iranian arms sales. He did know, and in fact, he did approve of the sale of weapons to Khomeini, and he did understand that part of this was an attempt to get the hostages out. The problem in determining Vice President Bush's role is that he contends that he never realized that this was, at bottom, a swap of arms for hostages. Now, we went back, talked to people who were in those meetings with him, examined the minutes of two long meetings that we were able to obtain, and it's clear that most of the other people in the room did understand that this was a swap of arms for hostages, and in fact, later on, it's become clear to everyone involved that it was an exchange like that. But Vice President Bush continues to contend that he never understood that. The second puzzling question about George Bush's participation it comes from a series of events in 1986 when Oliver North was actually recruiting George Bush to get involved in the arms deals, to intervene to try and push the arms deals along. And as part of that, North arranged quite a detailed briefing which Bush received, and the entire deal was laid before him. And at that point, Vice President Bush had a chance to intervene in this deal. He could have gone to President Reagan and said, let's go ahead, it's a good idea, or he could have gone to President Reagan and said, there's something fishy here, we ought to take a second look. And as far as we can tell, he did neither. He did nothing at all.
So you think he could have taken some initiative to stop the deal from happening?
He was clearly in a position to stop that deal at a couple of points, and he didn't.
You've created a picture of the Reagan White House where what was happening was the opposite of what we expect. We expect the president to be the controller of policy and of information with recommendations coming from his aides. What you describe in the Reagan White House is a lot of aides controlling the president, controlling a very passive president. Do you think that this is something that is unique to the Reagan White House, or do you think this is a trend that is happening in American politics where politicians are becoming the front people for other parties?
I don't mean for other political parties, I mean for other people. Yeah. I think Ronald Reagan's style of management, to use the euphemism that the Tower Commission adopted, probably is unique. We did interview historians and scholars of other presidencies and aides to other presidents, and they all said they could not imagine this set of circumstances occurring under a John Kennedy, a Richard Nixon, certainly a Franklin Roosevelt, or a Lyndon Johnson. Presidents generally get to where they are by being hands-on people who want to control power. Ronald Reagan is an unusual case for two reasons. One is that he is not a power-hungry man. He does not appear to be a grasping, ambitious man, and I think that's part of his charm. That's part of the reason for his success. The other reason is that I think more than any president of modern times, Ronald Reagan has understood how to use television, how to use a message, and how to get that message across to the people. Now, there is a trend that we probably will see continue through the next presidencies. Whatever the management style of the chief executive may be, the advances in the use of the press and the broadcast media that the Reagan campaigns and the Reagan administration used are probably going to become the pattern for anyone who wants to succeed in that business from now on.
Yet the press is very aware of how it's being manipulated. Why does the press allow that to happen?
Well, the press isn't given much choice, in a sense. In the first place, it has only become apparent to the press slowly and over these last 8 years what the extent of the manipulation was. But the other is that the White House is a place that is controlled, obviously, not by the press corps stuck in the press room, but by the people running the place. And what they were able to do in the Reagan administration, or for at least for most of the Reagan administration, was control the agenda, set up the famous event of the day, in a sense, turning many of those reporters into trained SEALs who were waiting for the fish to be tossed out of the plastic bucket. The problem is, or part of the problem, is that the White House has moved a good jump ahead, a generation ahead, in its techniques for dealing with the press. And the press has been slow to catch up. There are ways that the press can catch up, but they involve assigning a lot more people, spending a lot more time to burrow behind the scenes at the White House. I suspect those changes are going to happen, but they're going to be slow in coming.
Your book, Landslide, your investigative book into President Reagan's second term, is based largely on many interviews conducted with aides who worked with the president. They shared with you some pretty damaging information, and I was wondering why you think they spoke to you and gave you that information, what motivation they might have had.
Well, I'm glad you raised that point, because it is notable that this book relies on interviews with Ronald Reagan's own men. I don't think there's a Democrat quoted in this book. These are all Republicans talking about the president, and they're all Reagan Republicans. Why did they talk to us? For many of them, there was a sense of disappointment with this president. Ronald Reagan roared into office in 1981 with a rugged conservative agenda. But by 1985, that agenda had pretty much run out of gas, and by 1986, the administration had foundered on the shoals of Iran-Contra, which was a vivid scandal in its own right, but it was also a disaster that mirrored many of the flaws in the entire affair. So there are an awful lot of conservatives out there who worked for Ronald Reagan who wanted to go farther, who wanted to push their domestic and foreign agendas farther, and are still trying to figure out what went wrong.
As we speak, the presidential campaign is underway. The elections are right around the corner. What questions for the upcoming presidential election do you think your book raises?
Well, I think the electorate, the voters, are getting more sophisticated and are getting wise to the kind of techniques that the Reagan administration has used and that both candidates in this year's race have used in their campaign, staying away from the tough issues, relying on buzzwords, resonators, and one-liners instead of spelling out where they really want the country to go. And in a sense, the voters may be ahead of the candidates on this one. The polls show that the voters are by and large upset with both candidates and not terribly positive about either one. We may not solve that problem in this election, but my suspicion would be, if politicians are reading the polls out there, that by the next time around, we will find candidates who will move beyond that, incorporate the lessons of the Reagan campaigns. There will continue to be that glossy packaging, but get back to offering a concrete agenda as well.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been Doyle McManus, and he's the co-author with Jane Mayer of Landslide, The Unmaking of the President, 1984 to 1988. It's an investigative study of President Reagan's second term in office. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin. McManus is the Washington correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with columnist Anna Quinlan in her weekly syndicated column, Life in the 30s. Quinlan shares details of her daily life, her marriage, her children, her worries about aging, and other concerns of a woman in her 30s. Her columns have been collected in her new book, Living Out Loud. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, last call in a mafia tavern. Time for the small-time gangsters to go home and clear the bar for the mob chiefs. This is the setting for Nick Tosh's new novel about numbers runners and loan sharks. Tosh is also the author of Hellfire, a biography of rock and roller Jerry Lee Lewis. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from drummer and composer Jack DeJohnette in his band Special Edition. Kevin says the album's a good example of a band trying to walk the line between artistic expression and commercial success. And now the television critic David Bianculli has been exposed to more hours of Olympic coverage than he can possibly count. He examines NBC's coverage of the games and reviews a couple of the network's new sitcoms. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. A group holding four hostages released an Indian-born U.S. resident today in Syrian police West Beirut. Mithileshwar Singh was quickly taken to Damascus, where he's now being checked out in a local hospital. Singh had been held along with Americans Alan Steen, Jesse Turner, and Robert Polehill for the past 21 months. Singh was released outside the Kuwaiti embassy building in Beirut. State Department officials would not speculate as to why Singh was released now. The Discovery astronauts landed safely today at Edwards Air Force Base, ending a voyage that lasted just over 4 days. Some 425,000 spectators watched as the Discovery touched down on schedule at 9:37 Pacific time. Mission Control spokesman Blaine Hammond welcomed the crew back to Earth, calling the 1.5-million-mile journey a great ending to the new beginning. Campaigning in Hartford, Connecticut, Michael Dukakis praised the shuttle mission and America's space program.
About how we're going to revive the National Space Council, and the new vice president is going to chair it, and how we're going to have a space program second to none. And I'm very proud to announce the Discovery has just landed safely, and that's going to be the threshold of a great space program for the future.
George Bush attended the welcoming ceremony at Edwards Air Force Base, saying when the shuttle landed, "Wasn't that great?" An anti-drug bill was introduced in the Senate today, but NPR's Cokie Roberts reports passage of the politically popular measure is in doubt.
With all of the spending bills out of the way, the only major piece of legislation remaining that this Congress considers a must pass is the drug bill. The House of Representatives approved a measure to fight drugs, which included several highly controversial provisions, including the use of capital punishment for drug-related killings, a loosening of the rules of evidence, an imposition of civil penalties on drug users, and a denial of federal benefits to repeat drug offenders. The bill brought to the Senate today includes the death penalty for drug kingpins who commit murders, and several senators have indicated they will introduce amendments calling for the other House approved measures as well. But other senators have said they would filibuster some of those provisions, so despite the eagerness to adjourn, the drug bill could take some time and keep the Congress in Washington a while longer. I'm Cokie Roberts at the Capitol.
The United States Supreme Court opened its 1988-1989 term today and immediately began hearing cases. The justices already have a docket full of important cases, as NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
In terms of the legal hit parade, this year promises to be off the charts at the Supreme Court. The cases before the court are controversial, emotional, and affect almost every corner of American life. On the docket are cases testing the constitutionality of the death penalty for juveniles and for the retarded. Two other cases test whether it's constitutional to require drug testing for certain categories of federal employees. There are also race and sex discrimination cases, an affirmative action case, an important church-state case. The list goes on and on. But what makes this term even more fascinating than usual is the question of judicial choreography, how the justices will arrange themselves on these issues. This will be the first full term for the court's newest justice, Anthony Kennedy. His views in many areas are unknown. But if, as suspected, he sides with the other Reagan appointees on the court, the balance of the court could be tipped decidedly to the right with a new conservative coalition, and Ronald Reagan would have achieved his goal of Reaganizing the Supreme Court. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 7.5 points today to close at 2105.26. Declines led advances almost 2-to-1 on volume of 131 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange lost 7 cents. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For 10 years, drummer and composer Jack DeJohnette has led a series of bands, all with the same name, Special Edition. Groups noted for their clean sound and two saxophone front line. Our jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a new album from DeJohnette and the latest version of Special Edition. He says this incarnation of the band retains some of the trappings of its predecessors, but Special Edition's music is changing.
Over the last couple of years, drummer Jack DeJohnette has seemed torn between his sound creative instincts and an understandable desire to sell some records. Earlier versions of his group Special Edition were freewheeling all acoustic units. The current band, whose new album is Audio Visualscapes, a double-length set from Impulse, is more electrified and funky. Mick Goodrick plays electric guitar and guitar synthesizer. Lonnie Plaxico plays electric bass as well as his usual upright. And the band's two saxophonists sometimes play through harmonizers that add ghostly shadows to their lines. Clearly, DeJohnette's looking for a modern approach that sounds good and sells too. You can hear it in his composition PM's AM, a tribute to guitarist Pat Metheny's Sunny Morning Sound. As a drummer, Jack DeJohnette's strong suits are his freely dancing approach to his ride cymbals and his sensitivity as an accompanist. He amplifies the rhythm of a soloist line. Listen to his drumming behind Greg Osby's harmonized alto on Ornette Coleman's The Sphinx. The drummer doesn't always play to his own strengths. For Greg Osby's tune Donjo, DeJohnette programmed a drum machine to free him to play background keyboards. Inevitably, the synthetic percussion's even patterns and unwavering pulse have a flattening effect. When I saw Special Edition a few months ago, I thought the band's major weakness was that the two saxophonists sounded too much alike. Altoist Greg Osby and tenorist Gary Thomas have known each other for a decade, developing their styles at the same time and working together in several bands. On Jack DeJohnette's new album, though, their like-mindedness is more an asset than a liability. Their twisting solo lines define the band's character as much as the leader's vision does. That's particularly evident on a funky collective improvisation, Audio Visualscapes. We'll be right back. On Jack DeJohnette's new album, three of the eight performances are over 12 minutes long, giving everyone plenty of room to stretch. Gary Thomas sets aside his tenor to solo on flute and bass clarinet on DeJohnette's One for Eric, dedicated to multi-instrumentalist Eric Dolphy. Thomas gets to the essence of Dolphy's forceful work on flute. Jack DeJohnette paints his audiovisual scapes with a wide range of instrumental colors. Still, I miss the more minimal approach Special Edition used to embody. On their new album, the group seems conflicted, the drummer leading in one direction, the saxophonist in another. But one of the fascinating things about jazz is that opposing viewpoints can find a home inside one band.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed Audio Visual Scapes, a new album from Jack DeJohnette and Special Edition on the Impulse label. This is Fresh Air. Nick Toshis likes to write about people who live at the extreme ends of our culture. He chronicled the life of rock and roll wild man Jerry Lee Lewis in the acclaimed biography Hellfire, and followed that up with articles about Lewis's fallen evangelist cousin Jimmy Swaggart. New York street gangs and mob millionaires are some of Toshis's recent subjects. Now Toshis is creating fictional characters who live at the extremes. His first novel, Cut Numbers, is about the New York numbers racket, high finance, and greed. In setting the scene, Toshis was able to draw on his own experiences when he was 14, tending his father's bar in Newark, New Jersey. The main character in Cut Numbers is a loan shark who hangs out at after-hours bars.
At 6:30, Louis announced last call, and he pulled the cords that dangled from the two fluorescent lamps above the bar. The harsh, sudden light provoked the undead to move. Sniffling, bleeding, giggling, and gasping for air, they stumbled toward the door. Those who stayed for last call shrank from the light as if hurtling from awareness of their own ugliness. One by one and in pairs, they finished their drinks and left. As these stragglers departed, new faces began to arrive and to be served. Most of the stragglers knew that last call meant not that the place was shutting down, but that the place was changing. It happened every morning at about this time. The regulars were used to it, and only a few newcomers were foolish enough to complain. Besides, most did not want to stay beyond this time, for the faces that began to arrive at this time of the day were not the sort of faces to which they were accustomed or with which they were comfortable. Even the little Giovanostri, the tough-talking, swaggering young hoods who seemed to embody the moviegoers' fanciful notion of the evil in these streets, even they, who frightened the other punks, shied away from these faces, the eyes of which silenced them and stripped them of bravado and sundered their delusions. They were the faces of men whose own power gnawed within them like cancer, faces that had been recast by the renunciation of all trust and all love and all goodness.
So this shift in clientele is a difference between the small-time hoods and the low-level mafia members and the real big-time powerful people
right.
in organized crime.
Yeah, it takes place. This is in an after-hours joint in downtown New York, and it's the first after-hours shift versus the second after-hours shift, darkness versus daylight.
Have you been around for a lot of last calls yourself?
A few.
One of the characters in your novel is a small-time loan shark.
That's right.
And he expects that he's going to become real wealthy at this loan sharking business, and he has maybe $12,000 in the bank, and it's nothing like the $500,000 he expected to have by now. Why isn't he making it?
Because it looked good on paper and it didn't work out in real life. People don't pay back. People come up with excuses. People flee. People die. People go to jail. The guy thought it was going to be easy, and it turned out not to be.
Who did you model this on?
It's a collective picture of several Shylocks in New York.
That you know?
That I'm acquainted with, or was acquainted with.
Do you sympathize with them because they're not making the money they expected?
Not really. No more than I sympathize with anyone else. It's a rough way to make a living. And they're basically dealing with people that can't go to banks, and it's with good reason that banks turn them down, so they're at the high-risk end of things.
You know, every movie I've ever seen with a loan shark in it always ends up in this absolutely brutal beating, you know, because the person can never pay back, so of course they have all their limbs busted by some tough guy who comes in to punish them for not paying back on time. Well, I always wonder in these movies why anybody would go to a loan shark, because you know they're going to be dead before the movie's over.
Well, I guess that's the movies for you. In real life, they'd always prefer the money, and if a guy has a choice between getting hurt and getting the money up, I guess he gets the money rather than get beat up by a movie star with capped teeth, I guess.
Now, what interests you in writing about a loan shark?
Well, it's not so much the loan shark as it is the underlying principle of greed on every level. From a guy in the street who wants to play a horse and doesn't have the money to play a horse, on up to a gold precious metals broker on Wall Street, and they're all playing with the same deck, just on different levels.
Another character in your novel is heavy into the numbers racket. And hasn't been doing that well since the state lotteries and state lotto games have gone into effect, because they've siphoned off some of the money from the numbers racket. Is that actually the case?
Yeah, 8 years ago in New York, the state legalized the numbers and moved in on the racket guys who were controlling the Brooklyn and New York numbers. And at this point, New York State is probably the biggest numbers bookie in New York State.
How did you find out what you needed to about how the numbers racket works to write this book?
Well, ever since my childhood, I basically knew how the numbers racket worked. Where I grew up, there wasn't a person in the neighborhood that didn't play in numbers for a nickel or a dime or a few cents or whatever. You
know. How would that work?
Well, you would, person would go to whomever took the numbers for whomever, and say, for instance, here's a dime on 330, my address. Okay. Now, at the end of that day, if all the money bet at the racetrack had three final digits that ended in 330, you would be paid off at 500 to 1. So $50 on a dime.
Did you play and did you ever win?
I've played. I never played it that much. My grandmother was big into it. She couldn't read English, and so she used to ask me to. One of my earliest memories is her saying, look up a dead baby in a dream book. I said, well, she bet a nickel on it. I don't know if she hit or not. But it was prevalent. It was a way for people that weren't wealthy to get some action.
Explain what you just said, look up a dead baby in a dream book.
Well, they used to sell, they still do. Sell what they call dream books, and it's their listings alphabetically, you know, B for baby, C for car, and it would sort of interpret your dream. It was with probably the same degree of validity as you know, Freud or Jung, and then it would give you the number that the dream supposedly signified, and you were supposed to play that number, and probably the number came out as often as could be expected, but dream books are still sold. They're not as prevalent as they once were, though.
You get in a couple of swipes at Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
One of your characters says, good old Bruce, I got all his records. Usually I wear the little rag around the head like him and everything. These days with Liberace dead and all, Bruce is all that's left. You don't like Springsteen?
I can't stand him.
Why not?
I think he's an overblown wimp. I don't know. He's, you know, I'm sick of this. These millionaires singing about problems of the working man. False emotions. I don't know. I hope his ex-wife takes him for a ride.
You wrote a biography of Jerry Lee Lewis
That's
called
right.
Hellfire. When the Jimmy Swaggart sex scandal broke, you were following that as well. Jerry Lee Lewis was the wild man of rock and roll. Jimmy Swaggart, one of the television preachers. Do you see them in their own ways being flip sides of the same coin?
Yes, I do. At this point, though, I think it's debatable which side is which. The thing I find most interesting about Swaggart is I think he actually believes he was possessed by the devil in doing these sort of tame sexual frolics down there.
Well, the devil was a source of really potent imagery for Jerry Lee Lewis. Could you get to the bottom of why they both felt so involved with the devil, and one became a preacher to fight against it, and the other kind of gave into all those urges?
Yeah, the one, Jerry Lee, basically damned himself to hell for being ungodly, and Jimmy Lee Swaggart basically exalted himself to heaven for being godly, and I think what they it'd be a great idea if they went on tour together. Jerry Lee at this point doesn't have a recording contract, and Jimmy Swaggart doesn't have a future. So, and they're both terrific musicians.
Okay. Well, good. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Nick Toshis' new novel, Cut Numbers, is published by Harmony Books.
Love you like I love a sugar. You're fine. So kind. Got to tell this world that you're mine. Ain't you my man? And I quit on my thumb. Real nervous, somebody show is fun. Come on, baby. Drive crazy. This is great. Balls of fire.
This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Robert Siegel and see what they have planned. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What story are you following?
Well, we're following the political situation in Chile. You know, on Wednesday, there's to be a referendum on continuing the Pinochet regime. And Tom Gelton has a special report on the situation there and how people are looking toward that that vote. Also, we meet Tatiana Tolstaya. She's a Russian short story writer. She's been called one of the important voices of her generation of Soviet writers, and she is a visiting writer-in-residence in Virginia at the University of Richmond. Also, Nina Totenberg takes a look ahead with us at the session of the U.S. Supreme Court that began today.
Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week in the post-Olympic afterglow, NBC is getting back to its regular programming. Television critic David Bianculli has a reflection on the network's Olympic coverage and a review of a couple of their new programs.
When NBC wasn't cutting away from an Olympic event to cram in more commercials, it was jumping from event to event so quickly that there was no chance to get involved in anything. It was a clear-cut case of Olympus interruptus, and it was just too annoying to be overlooked. That's why I've decided to take the two new sitcoms NBC is premiering this week, Dear John and Empty Nest, and cover them the way NBC covered the Olympics. First up is Dear John, in which Judd Hirsch of Taxi will try to go for a second gold medal in the quality sitcom event. Dear John is in the same Thursday night time slot as Taxi was. It's by some of the same producers and has the same wonderful assortment of oddballs. The premise here is that Hirsch, as lonely guy John Lacey, has just gotten divorced and shows up at a community center to attend one of several self-help groups being held there.
Good evening. My name is Frank, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hurdle that you will ever face. You won half the battle. And with courage, just and determination. Support of these friends, you're almost there. Yes, John,
yeah.
Please, this is John.
Oh, hi, good evening. My name is John, and I'm in the wrong room.
We'll be back with more about Dear John after this. Ted Turner's newest network, called TNT for Turner Network Television, is launched this week with a two-part showing of Gone with the Wind, followed Wednesday night by its first made-for-TNT program, a documentary called The Making of a Legend. It's a behind-the-scenes look at the making of Gone with the Wind, and it's a fascinating, well-researched film. Great stuff. Hi, we're back. And just a few moments ago, on the set of Empty Nest, Richard Mulligan kicked off his new NBC series by answering a phone call and getting a lot of laughs. Mulligan plays a pediatrician and a widower in this spin-off of The Golden Girls. In fact, Empty Nest follows The Golden Girls on Saturday nights beginning this weekend. Mulligan's co-stars include Christy McNichol of Family and David Leisure of the Isuzu commercials. But let's pick up the action with Mulligan alone and on the phone.
So it's sunny up there in New York, huh? But Willard Scott had a big sun over New York. How could it be raining? Yeah, well, if Willard would spend a little less time on the date nut cake from Vermont, a little more time on the maps.
There's a lot more action to come, but since Dear John is even funnier than Empty Nest, let's go back and spend a moment in time with Judd Hirsch as John Lacey, who's finally found the therapy group he meant to attend.
There isn't much to tell. I was divorced 6 months ago. We were married for 10 years.
What made you leave her?
Well, actually, she left me, Kirk. She left me for a man that I considered to be my best friend.
Why?
Well, we used to go to basketball games together and hang out and have a few beers.
Dear John looks like it may get the gold, Empty Nest could get the silver, and for the past few weeks, viewers of NBC's Olympics have been getting the shaft. And now this.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, Musim Mayer describes growing up with a father totally obsessed by his art. She's written a memoir about her father, Philip Guston, who was a leading figure in the abstract expressionist movement. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the life and untimely death of Chuck Willis. Willis first made it big as an R&B star. Ed explains how he also became King of the Stroll. And book critic John Leonard reviews The Question of Who, the new novel from Yale historian Jonathan Spence. So I hope you can join us, and we'd like to welcome the listeners of KSTX, a new station in San Antonio, Texas. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Salat, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vablitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.